The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to The Waves for Thursday, September 27th, the Horseplay Edition. I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of the Slate podcast Outward. And joining me for today's episode is someone you might remember, an old friend from way back when. WNYC producer Verilyn Williams. Welcome home, Verilyn.
Hey, Christina.
We're also excited to welcome a new guest this week, Kristen Meinzer, co-host of the podcast By the Book. Woo-hoo! Hi, Kristen.
Thanks so much for having me with you guys. I'm so excited.
Yeah, we've been wanting to have you on for a while, so I'm really happy it worked out this week. Kristen's podcast By the Book forces her to live by self-help books to the letter, and she will not tell us what book she is living by right now, but the next season of her podcast is in production and you should listen to it to find out how she's torturing herself. This week we're going to kick things off with a discussion of Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's choice for the open seat on the Supreme Court, who has been publicly accused of sexual harassment and assault by two women, one of whom is actually testifying at a Senate hearing today. Then we'll talk about weight and how the cultural stigma against fatness may pose more of a health risk to overweight people than obesity itself. And for our final topic, we'll talk about Napoli Ever After, a new Netflix movie about a Black woman's decision to cut off all her hair after years of trying to make it, quote unquote, perfect. Then for our Slate Plus segment, we're going to decide whether public marriage proposals are sexist. Mm-hmm. And if you're not a Slate Plus member and you would like to know whether proposing to your boo in front of hundreds of people is sexist, you can start your free two-week Slate Plus trial by visiting slate.com/thewavesplus. All right, Brett Kavanaugh. So for the past 2 weeks, we've been talking in the news about these two women who have stated publicly that Kavanaugh subjected them to sexual violence. Christine Blasey Ford, a professor, says he attempted to rape her, covering her mouth and ripping off her clothes when she was 15 and he was 17. And just recently, Deborah Ramirez came out in The New Yorker saying he shoved his exposed genitals in her face at a party when they were both freshmen at Yale. So at first, it kind of seemed like members of the Republican Party were at least making a show of acting like they wanted to hear Ford out. Trump said last week, if it takes a little delay, it'll take a little delay. They'll go through a process and hear everybody out. I think it's important. It's so nice of him. Now he's calling it a con game. He said Ramirez was, quote, totally messed up. Senator Orrin Hatch said the second allegation, Ramirez's, was phony. Mitch McConnell says that that accusation was part of a coordinated smear campaign by the Democrats designed to tear down a good man. So now they're not even pretending like, you know, they might believe these women or that these accusations might be credible. They're just acting like it's a big political game. And there's so much we could talk about here. There's the Republican theory that possibly Brett Kavanaugh has a doppelganger that Christine Blasey Ford is confusing him with, that actually somebody else attempted to rape her. Chuck Grassley, another senator, was whining about how inconvenient it was that he was forced to schedule a fifth day of the hearings. Ford is testifying today, of course. But I want to start with the picture that it paints of this specific kind of high school and college party culture and bro culture, which to me felt so vivid and true in both of these accounts, where not only is somebody, allegedly Brett Kavanaugh, perpetrating sexual violence against these women, but he's surrounded by men egging each other on when they're all drunk. Mm-hmm. They're sort of using these women's bodies as a vehicle for their socializing, bonding over their shared contempt for women. And there's all these details in both of the allegations, like somebody in college, Ramirez's accusation, where, you know, they're all drunk, they're in a common room in a dorm. He or somebody allegedly pulls down his pants and shoves his penis in her face. Somebody yells, "Kiss it," and someone else yells down the hall, "Brett Kavanaugh just put his penis in Debbie's face." Like, that. Not that I've had that exact experience, but that to me felt so much like something a college boy or a set of college boys would do. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely performing aggression for the other men in the room rather than performing sexually for a willing partner. And the idea that it's comedic or that people would laugh at a woman's discomfort, it's clearly not for her benefit in any way. This whole culture of male fraternity or boys will be boys or what have you.
Horseplaying.
Yes, horseplay. That's a word that keeps coming up. It's preposterous, and yet it has centuries of social acceptance with it, too. And I forgot who it was. Somebody in the White House was saying that, you know, if these guys are going to be getting in trouble for these kinds of things, aren't we all guilty?
I would put an exclamation point and highlighted that section. I was like, yep, yes.
Yes, you're all guilty. Yes, all of you are guilty.
And I was thinking about it, too, just like in the, like, there was that song, Ain't No Fun If The Homie Can't Get None. I can't remember who sang it, but I do know that that was a refrain that was said in my junior high school. And that's also the way I think in which, like, we're just socialized to believe that men can do whatever they want at any point. And it's not about the person that they're doing it with. It's about their friends and the way that they're being perceived by their social group. I, when I was thinking about this type of school environment, I was just like, this happens everywhere. Like, even, you know, one of the most horrific moments in my life was coming. So my parents have a 2-family house and they were renting the first floor to a single mom and her son. And I came home and there was like music, and it was clear that there was a bunch of people in the house. And I walk into the teenage boy's room and it was like about 7 boys and 2 girls sitting there. Yeah. And it was so clear that, like, you know, they were all just kind of like sitting there, but it was so that something insidious was about to go down, or, you know, it was just like they were circled and the girls were in the middle. And so I think things like that happen all the time. And young women are just like left to kind of feel like, well, this is just the way that things are, and like they not feeling like there's any agencies in that moment to say, like, I don't want to do anything for the pleasure of your entertainment, you know? So I think it's just like, yeah, I think the thing about these school groups is maybe like the privilege that comes along with it, or feeling like these are people that come from a quote unquote respectable house or respectful parents or whatever the case might be, and feeling like, is this person capable of this horrible thing? And the answer is always yes.
This is something that's perpetuated in pop culture constantly. I think about all of the teen movies that generations of people have grown up with. One movie I always think about is Revenge of the Nerds, where it is taken for granted that having sex with a girl without her consent is a source of comedy. Look at how dumb she is. Mm-hmm. How did she not figure this out? Or was she so drunk that she was? And I mean, and that's lots of movies. 16 Candles.
I was so taken aback by the 16 Candles. I've never watched 16 Candles.
That's okay. You don't have to.
But the way that Jake Ryan's character was described in one of the articles we read.
In the Vox article by Anna North.
Yeah, yeah. With Caroline, and she wakes up the next morning and she was unconscious and the other boy had sex with her. Which is to say, the boy raped her. Like, this actually was in the film. I was reading this and I was like, this happened?
Yeah, yeah. It's comedy. Ha ha. All the guys are laughing. Ha. Oh
my God. Actually, we just talked about the Netflix rom-com To All the Boys I Loved Before a month or so ago, and they're still talking about that movie as sort of the quintessential teen movie it's so fun that everyone gets to watch. I didn't even remember the fact that there was that whole, you know, rapey aspect to it. But what you mentioned, Verilyn, you know, women not feeling agency to say, like, this isn't fun, this isn't funny, I don't want to be used as an object for your bonding. Mm. The thing that it continues to infuriate me about this Kavanaugh situation is the fact that there are so many women not only supporting him, but women who knew him in high school and college saying, well, of course he never did this. And there's 65 women signed a letter to say, like, oh, well, he never sexually assaulted me. I mean, like, the concept behind a letter like that is laughable just because you obviously can never know whether someone has sexually assaulted anyone else just because they didn't sexually assault you. Like, but also, I think there's pressure among women and from men to women to turn a blind eye to the kinds of sexual victimization that men perpetrate on college campuses and at drunk high school parties, because there's a social cachet to just being able to look the other way or to join in the laughter or to think, you know, oh, that's how boys – aren't boys crazy sometimes? And you're sort of part of the cool group. And it's almost like a parable how perfect this story is. There was a woman, Renate Schroeder Dolphin, signed this letter saying, you know, Brett Kavanaugh is such a great guy. He would never do something like this. Meanwhile, there's in Brett Kavanaugh's senior yearbook in high school, he had a phrase under his picture that he put, Renate Alumnius. This is along with him saying that he was the treasurer of the Keg City Club and the biggest contributor to the Beach Week Ralph Club. He put the phrase Renate Alumnius. Turns out a lot of the football players had that phrase next to their photo. And it was in reference to this woman, Renate Schroeder, now Renate Schroeder Dolphin. According to Kavanaugh, the fact that they attended a high school event together and shared a brief kiss goodnight.
Which she denies. She says they never kissed.
Now she's comes out and says, you know, I didn't even know that was in the yearbook until someone brought it up to me. I don't know what that means. I can't begin to comprehend what goes through the minds of 17-year-old boys who write such things, but the insinuation is horrible, hurtful, and simply untrue. Meanwhile, I'm trying to muster some sympathy for her, but I kind of can't because she signed this letter saying, like, oh, he would never do such a thing. When it seems like if you were friends with him at that time and you knew he ran in this crowd, and even if you didn't, how would you know that he never sexually assaulted anyone? But now she wants to say it's so hurtful and wow, what a hurtful thing for a 17-year-old boy to do. But his explanation of that, you know, oh, the fact that we all put that we were alumni of this woman in our yearbook meant that we
I cannot.
Right. That we shared a kiss. That sounds like something you would tell your parents who found your yearbook and they're like, son, you know, what does Renate Alumnius mean? What does Beach Week Ralph Club mean? And you're like, oh, we shared a brief kiss goodnight after a high school event. It was all very chaste. All of this information that's coming out now is refuting the picture that he has painted, which is that he wasn't a crazy person who might get blackout drunk and try to rape someone. That he did, in fact, run in the sorts of crowds that might do that sort of thing.
The fact is, every session, cases around sexual assault or maybe even the way men and women are treated or maybe pay wage, there are just so many potential cases that will come up to the Supreme Court that I just don't want someone on there that thinks that the way that he is alleged to treat women as a teenager is okay. Like, I kind of feel like it's the Handmaid's Tale effect. You know, like the fact that Renee Schroeder Dolphin felt like, you know, regardless of the way her experiences in high school, that she could just dismiss it. Because she thinks that ultimately having him on will be more to her benefit than not. I mean, it's all fun and games until you get your finger cut off, right?
That's well, like a, I've never heard that.
That's a
get your eye poked out.
A Handmaid's Tale deep cut.
But I have to, I just have to interject here and say, you know, Christina, you were saying you don't really have any sympathy for Renate Dolphin in this case, but I actually do. I think women internalize a lot of sexism and we are taught to put up with a lot of stuff that we shouldn't have to put up with. And we're taught to put up with people hurting us all the time. And maybe she didn't even realize the number of ways that he was hurting her or hurting others until she saw this evidence in the yearbook about she was essentially a club where every man could park his penis if, you know, or whatever's being implied there.
But that's so frustrating. It's like people cannot have sympathy or empathy for others until it happens to them. It's just, right. To me, it just feels like I'm just tired of that narrative. I'm just like very...
Oh, I hear exactly what you guys are saying, but I have sympathy for her because, I mean, it breaks my heart, the idea of any woman just being proof of a whole bunch of men. It was 14 mentions in this yearbook about how they can have sexual exploits at a girl's expense.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, I have sympathy. Obviously, like, I don't know if sympathy, I have empathy. Like, yeah. I feel like this is why we're fighting. Like, this is the whole point. Like, so you too don't have to have this experience people that are in high school right now don't have to have experiences like this. Like, this is what it's all about. And yeah, women internalize sexism and perpetuate things that are harmful to themselves. I think, though, that we have to call it out. Because if we don't call it out, then you can't have corrective behavior.
Yeah. And I'm not saying she should have ever signed that letter in the first place. All of the pain I feel for her is because of what was in that yearbook. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Mm.
The other thing that I've been thinking about a lot is that, you know, what you two were saying before about, like, yes, you are all guilty. Yes, like, this is common. We see this happening all the time. That's sort of one strain of narrative that us, like, we feminists and people who are invested in the rights and health and well-being of women are putting forth. The other one is that this isn't normal high school behavior, that, you know, hashtag not all men have attempted rape, and that to say, like, oh, this is just something high school boys do is sort of minimizing the severity of the allegations against him. And I sort of go back and forth between those two ways of looking at it. Like, yes, this culture and sexual assault and sexual harassment is pervasive and systemic, but also these allegations are not, should not be sort of poo-pooed away by saying all high school boys do them. How do you guys reconcile those two truths?
The part of me that hesitates to be like, it should all be criminalized is just knowing the ways in which other, like, race and racism will impact, you know, black boys over, you know, the fact that Bill Cosby is going to jail for, you know, was this sentence. I, on the one hand, you know, the shrug emoji, like, that's literally my feeling about the whole thing was like, well, you know, you do the crime. But then also, you know, how many women had to come forward before Harvey Weinstein was even, you know, any charge was put against him? There are ways in which I know that young boys of color, the society that says that this behavior is okay, are going to get criminalized a lot more for the same, like, horrible behavior that impacts and traumatizes mostly young women, but not always, right? There's, you know, a lot of this, these boys will be boys, things that happen for the benefit of other boys sometimes, a lot of times, affect young boys as well, in sexual ways or just harassment ways, or definitely in ways that lead them to be sexually harassed, right? And so I think I'm holding all of that and answering you and saying that, like, we definitely need to start advocating for consent more. Like, consent just needs to be something that, like, enthusiastic consent is something that we need to be preaching to our young kids, like, right now. But I think criminalizing, and this is, like, this is the hard part, where it's just, like, all that being said, I feel like criminalizing what we consider what is known as boys will be boys, the hard part is just knowing that it's not going to affect the Brett Kavanaughs of the world, right? It's not going, like, I think of 13 Reasons Why, that series on, also a Netflix series, that series, and, you know, the jock in that was, like, literally, you know, like, raping, you know, rape multiple people that were on the show, and, like, was accused of taking pictures and, like, being, you know, drugging young women. Like, that was all known, and he still got off, right? Sorry for that spoiler.
Yeah, but I mean, this isn't limited to fiction either. There's Brock Turner, yes, you know, the guy who sexually assaulted a woman behind a dumpster at Stanford University, who got 6 months in jail, which was then reduced to, I think, just about 3 months in jail, you know, because they said, well, he lost his swimming scholarship. That's exactly what the judge said. That's a punishment enough for him.
Yeah.
We've seen disparities in how crimes are prosecuted and how justice and injustice is meted out in real life, too.
You know, and meanwhile, Emmett Till, you know, like, it just, to me, is just, it just, I mean, I feel, I don't know if I'm being hyperbolic, but that's where my mind went.
No, I totally get where you're coming from. Somebody who is black and male and looks at a woman, quote, the wrong way versus Brock Turner, case doesn't deserve any punishment at all, and the other one receives no punishment at all, even though it deserves it. So I totally get what you're saying, Verilyn.
I've also been thinking about the question of whether sexual assault, you know, if somehow it was proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which is not the standard of proof here, by the way, but, you know, if he did indeed commit the sexual assault that he's been accused of, do we think that sexual assault makes somebody particularly unqualified to rule on the Supreme Court on issues of women's rights? Or because I don't think it does. I think that sexual assault should make somebody ineligible for that the job that Brett Kavanaugh is seeking. But I don't think it makes somebody particularly unqualified to make decisions about women because, you know, people who are pro-women's rights sexually assault women, too. Mm. And I've been thinking about Bill Clinton a lot because of Slow Burn, which we talked about on the episode 2 weeks ago. And the fact that he, you know, multiple credible allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment have been brought against him. I think it's inarguable that he has very little respect for women in his life. Yet he was really good on women's rights in office, you know, certain women's rights in office. Of course, like, you know, in terms of the crime bill and stuff, you could argue that women suffered more under him. But that was an argument for keeping him in office among some feminists.
I mean, I just don't want anybody who rapes to be in office. I don't want anyone to get a lifetime appointment. I don't want the public
wow,
to vote
Kristen,
for them.
What a radical proposition.
I just don't. I just don't want you there. Why can't we have, you know, a whole Supreme Court of Ruth Bader Ginsburgs and no Kavanaughs? Why can't we just do that? I don't want the rapist there.
And I also, I also just like, what are the documents that never released? Like, I'm just also like, there probably are other things that we should probably be looking at. In a way, I'm always just like, is this distraction? It's like, why is all of this happening? I'm stuck in my scandal reality where I'm just like, scandal is way more realistic than it is. I'm like, if this is the story that's happening, what is the story that's not happening?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Ramirez allegations, by the time that they came out in The New Yorker, the lead of the story was basically that Senate staffers had been looking at these allegations for some time, and same with Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. Dianne Feinstein and a couple other people had known about those allegations for a while and were just sort of, you know, wondering when to bring them up, or wondering, you know, Christine Blasey Ford was deciding whether or not to come out. So it's certainly possible that we'll find out more in coming days and weeks, and I'm really looking forward to. I'm actually going to Christine Blasey Ford's Senate hearing today, so we'll see if there's more stuff for us to talk about on future episodes. All right, listeners, let us know how you've been processing the Kavanaugh case, whether the allegations about these high school and college parties ring true to you. You can email us at thewaves@slate.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, our next topic. Last week, HuffPost published a big article by Michael Hobbs titled "Everything You Know About Obesity Is Wrong." Kristen, why don't you tell us a little bit about the piece?
Yeah, so this is a huge piece, including a lot of research, not only about the prejudice that fat people face in the world, how the medical treatment they receive is frequently substandard, all the fat shaming that happens in this world, and specifically also about how fat people, what we're doing in our culture is blaming them for their size when there are bigger structural issues that are causing people to be fat, and how fat doesn't necessarily equal healthy, and there are other measurements of health that are not visible and that are not on a scale, things like vegetable consumption or even how strong your grip is that tell you much more about a human's health than what their BMI is, their body mass index. And so the piece goes a lot of different places. There are a couple of moments where it also touches on race and class, but for the most part, it's really about how we demonize obesity and why we shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, the thing that stuck with me from this piece was something that I'd actually read in other places before. I mean, a lot of the stuff that he's talking about is not new research, but he brings it together in a way that is shocking. I mean, the fact that dieting just doesn't work. And researchers and scientists and nutritionists have known that since the 50s and 60s, that 95 to 98% of attempts to lose weight fail. And the vast majority of dieters end up gaining back more than they lost. And yet, still, the diet industrial complex is making more money than movies in the U.S. I mean, it's remarkable to me that the stories in the piece that touched me the most were about people going to their doctors and having their doctors basically shame them for being fat and then telling them that, you know, that that's for their own good, that if maybe if you're ashamed of being fat, you'll just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, stop eating so much, exercise more, and lose all that weight when, A, it might not be necessary because, as you said, Kristen, fat doesn't necessarily mean you're unhealthy. And B, it's impossible that your metabolism actually changes when you lose a lot of weight from a diet. It changes such that you gain a bunch of weight back again.
Yeah, I mean, the piece even says just losing 3% of your body weight, just 3%, slows down your metabolism by 17%. And on top of that, all that shaming, it kicks in a stress hormone that makes you hungrier. So when doctors are shaming their patients and telling them to lose weight, it's setting them up for failure. They just can't win. They can't win.
And the thing about it, too, that I was, you know, in reading this, is also the way in which, of course, capitalism plays in all this, that nutritionists only get paid as little as $24 to provide a session, and that primary care physicians are only expected to get 15 minutes per appointment. Like, I just think in 15 minutes, like, what can you do in 15 minutes? Like, I don't know. Like, I can't. Like, when I go, luckily, I have an amazing dermatologist that I actually spend a lot of time with talking about things I probably should be talking to a primary care physician about. But, like, the things that we talk about is literally just, like, you know, what am I eating? You know, I'm supposed to mostly be gluten free. If I'm not being gluten free, like, what else am I cutting out? Like, the kind, you know, we talk about these things that take, I don't know, like, I don't think about time, but the idea that there will be a physician thinking about 15 minutes, and then if they, like, look at you and make assumptions about, you know, what they already think that you're doing or not doing because of your size, then, yeah, it's more cost effective to just be like, lose weight, period.
And it's almost like treating obesity as a health crisis is creating a health crisis, that the stigma around it is causing more harm than the actual thing, because people who believe they're fat and try to go on a diet will get into unhealthy eating habits or starve themselves and binge or food will be surrounded by shame for them. And that never leads to healthy eating practices, or not going to doctors because you think if you go to the doctor because your ankle hurts, your doctor will just look at you and say, well, lose weight, when something's actually wrong with you that has nothing to do with your weight. And so actual health problems are being ignored and dismissed by people because they don't want to go to physicians because they feel like they'll just be dismissed because of their weight, because they are being dismissed because of their weight.
Yeah, they are being dismissed. And one thing that Michael Hobbs talks about in his piece is the rates of undiagnosed ovarian and breast cancer in fat women. It's so much higher because the women, when they go to the doctor, either A, they're not being looked at for those issues, or the women stop going to the doctor entirely so they don't even get diagnosed because they are so shamed every time they walk into a doctor's office. Some doctors in the piece admit that they have an alarm that goes off when they're about to see a fat patient.
I'm remembering this wrong, but isn't it that they don't, like, they have to look at the weight, and if whenever someone is above a certain weight, they get an alarm that tells them, so that way they spend extra, because most of the time they just, like, are very passive, and that's because of, like, they might not be able to get reimbursed for certain things that they do to a patient. So it's all about money
if they don't talk about their weight.
They literally get
a physical alarm that rings on their system to say, you have to tell this person to lose weight, otherwise the insurance won't reimburse them for the services.
Yeah, and this gets to the fact that it's not just individuals and individual doctor bias. This is a bigger systemic issue. And, you know, the piece also gets to those big systems about food distribution. And what's available to whom and at what cost. And if everybody was healthier just by eating more vegetables, shouldn't we all eat more vegetables? But no, that's not possible when only 4% of the farm subsidies go to fruits and vegetables.
Oh my gosh, that made me so angry.
It makes me so mad. It shouldn't be more expensive to eat an apple than a bag of chips. But it is cheaper to eat a bag of chips than an apple.
And even when I go to Sierra Leone, like, I eat rice every single day and I'll come back and like be fitter. Like, I think it's literally the way that our foods are processed. The fact that it's all about money and like, how do we make this faster? How do we make this cheaper? And that's what's unhealthy, not necessarily the consumptions or the type of foods. And yeah, the fact that, you know, there are vegetable based and most of the stews that I grew up with have vegetables in them. Like, that's the whole thing. So I think it's more just the way that we think about meals here in America. And also, I don't know if the piece got into portion sizes, but I will say that when I've traveled, portion sizes are a lot different in other countries.
Well, the piece does actually get a little bit to portion size. And one thing it says that I think would surprise a lot of Americans is we actually now in America consume fewer calories per person per day than we did in 2003. So it's not even about the caloric intake. It's that the food we're eating isn't food necessarily. Mm-hmm. And when we're eating non-food, it's not good for our bodies.
Yeah. I saw that earlier this week on Monday, the Weight Watchers CEO, Mindy Grossman, announced that the company will no longer be called Weight Watchers. It's shortening its name to WW. And it's pivoting to wellness, not weight. The new tagline is wellness that works, because it's been, you know, it's sort of a faux pas now to say like you're on a diet, you're watching your weight. It's all about wellness and clean eating. What do you guys think about that?
So I'm showing Kristen an email that I just got from WW. And so the email now, it says Team WW. And I'm like, what is this? What team am I on? And then it, like, you scroll down. So I'm realizing as you're talking that this is actually Weight Watchers, but rebranded. And it's of a couple walking together in a park. And it says, fall in love with WW. And so it's the same, you know, it still talks about, you know, food and losing and smart points and all that same stuff. It's just rebranding and re-messaging. This is just a different advertising. It's all about capitalism and money.
Yeah.
I feel like June.
It's true. And I think another thing that I've been thinking about with this article, the photos that accompany it are really beautiful. I would suggest going to our website to click on the link to it, or just going onto Huffington Post and looking for it yourself. But the photographers and the editors told the people who posed for photos, you have complete control over this photo shoot. You tell us how you want to be depicted, what you want to wear, and everyone. And, you know, these are all fat people who have struggled with the diet industrial complex or being shamed by doctors. And they get to explain why they chose to wear a bathing suit or be, you know, having hiked a mountain with their two kids or having their face obscured because they don't want anyone to recognize them. And it drove home to me that the pressure to diet and to be thin or to not be fat is about more than just beauty standards or standards of sexual desirability. It's about just having the right to be a full person, to exist in the world without incurring judgment for having a body. And so it's not just women. I think a lot of times when people talk about the pressure to lose weight, it's very gendered, and it is very gendered, but, you know, the majority of sources in this are women. And one of the most disturbing statistics in the piece that I read was that half of 3 to 6 year old girls say that they worry about being fat. Three to six. I'm sure they, like, a 3 year old can barely say, like, I feel fat, you know, yet they worry about it. But this is something that affects people of all genders, and it's not necessarily about like looking hot to get a guy to pay attention to you or something like that, which I think infects a lot of the narrative about weight loss in the US.
And I think about, like, there's a meme that goes around that I think about a lot, is like, I wish I was the size now that I was when I was first told that I was fat. And I think about that all the time because I look at pictures of myself when I was younger, and I was just like, wow, like, I thought I was fat, which is, it's true. Like, that was a lot of my childhood. And, you know, and one thing I will say about the piece that I was feeling reading it, I mean, obviously, I think it was supposed to evoke a sense of like, it starts out by talking about scurvy and just how people weren't taking it seriously. And all these more people died until something actually happened. And so I think it is supposed to incite a sense of like, we need to do something now, people. But I wish that there was more, because there are communities, there are people that aren't. Like being big is not a dire situation, or, you know, they are just like buying clothes that are their size or thinking about ways in which to make lifestyle work for them. As far as, you know, the way that we think about the healthcare system, the way that we think about grooming. There's a podcast that I started listening to called Cocktails and Confidence, and it's by two, body pause bloggers, and there's this whole community which I knew nothing about of people just saying like, this is my size, this is my body, get used to it. And like they have conversations about what does it mean to get a wax as a plus size person living in this body, like what does it mean to have sex, and you know, what are the different positions besides missionary, you know. So like literally the conversations that everybody are just like, okay, well, how do I do it in this body? And I guess I wish that there was more of that in this piece, because I think like what make, you know, going to the next conversation that we're about to have around hair and Black women's hair, I think like what for me has made me the most acceptable about my body and myself is by the affirmations, the like, you know, ooh, girl, you look cute in that dress, or you know what I mean, or like, you know, have you been to Forever 21? They have a new plus size section, and like, look at this cute dress that I got, you know, like the more of the affirming ways and the ways in which people are getting affirmation. I think it's sometimes, at least for me, the ways in which I've been more acceptable about my body and thinking about, okay, it's not about dieting, it's about like including more greens in my food. You know what I mean? Like those are the kind of ways, like let's talk about it in a positive way as opposed to a dire way. Cause I think the dire ways still feels like, well, damn, like regardless of all this stuff, that all the stuff is happening to me, and it's like feels less like you have agency and to do anything about it.
Wow. That's a really good point. I think that's a good ending note. Unless, Kristen, did you have something else?
I think that's a perfect place to end it. I do.
Listeners, let us know if you have any other recommendations for body affirming media we can consume, and what you thought about this piece, which I thought was pretty fantastic. TheWaves@slate.com. Napoli Ever After.
Yay.
It's a new Netflix original rom-com. Apparently, rom-coms are, there's a ton of them coming out from Netflix right now. The movie dropped on Friday. It's based on a series of books by Trisha R. Thomas. Verilyn, why don't you give us a little synopsis?
Oh my goodness. When I finished watching this, I think I tweeted something like, this is the movie that I deserved. It was just so fun. And okay, so it's about a woman named Violet Jones, played by Sanaa Lathan. And she, her whole life, because she has a controlling mom, played by the one and only Lynn Winfield, which I was so happy to see her. I think she's been doing like Greenleaf and stuff, but I haven't like really just like seen her like in this like devilish role, which she iconically did in The Thin Line Between Love and Hate, if anybody remembers that movie. And so her mom is controlling, and her mom has shaped her whole life, or like beat into her head that she needs to be the perfect young woman. And a big part of that is keeping your hair straight. It starts off with a scene of her wanting to jump into a pool, and you know, she's obviously been told like, you better not. And then she jumps and her mom's like loses her ish. And then the kids in the pool, like when she came up, of course, her straight hair has, her curls have popped, as they do. And the kids are like, oh, cheer pet, you know. And so what I loved about this rom-com, mostly because it didn't shy away also from like, because it was about Black hair, race in this way. I think like a lot of times when you think about rom-coms, it's like everything is very surface level. And I think like for most women of color, our love lives are complicated in all these different ways because we live in a world where race is a thing, where, you know, capitalism and wages and all these different economic factors. Maybe we have family that need money. Like, I've always think about rom-coms and feeling like that is not something that I could ever aspire to, because that's not the way my life works, right? And so it was so nice to see Sanaa kind of grapple with the reality of what it means to live as a Black woman in a Eurocentric world, whether it comes to like her relationship. So I feel like I'm doing a horrible job at recapping this. So she's this woman that's grown up to think that the ideal is this like straight hair, beautiful. So we meet her in present day in bed with her boo. And and we see that she gets up and she fixes her hair before he wakes up. And we've seen women do this. Like, I was watching it and I was like, this is something that I feel like I've seen white women do all the time. You know, you get up, you spray your hair, you make sure you smell nice, and you go back in bed and you pretend like that's the way that you woke up. That's like a trope that we've seen over and over and over again.
That was... I'm going to let you finish, Marilyn, I have things to say about that.
No, go ahead.
And I know not all relationships are like this, but I was just like, straight relationships are so weird. Like, you're going to get up before he gets up to do your hair and makeup and then like silently slip back into bed. And you've been dating for 2 years.
For 2 years.
And this sort of sets off an argument that she has with her boyfriend and the reason why they break up at the beginning. You know, the fact that he's like, oh, I don't feel like I know you. You never let your hair down around me, pun intended, whatever. But I also think, like you said, Verlin, that is something that women do. And it's just so crazy to me. And I think about how much more sleep people could get if they didn't, A, do that, but B, also have to do so much or choose to do so much to look a certain way. And that was the sort of, because, you know, I'm not Black and so I couldn't directly relate to all the struggles that she faces around her hair. But for me, the idea of like how much money I would save and how much time I would save if I wasn't a woman and have to like pluck my eyebrow, not have to, choose to, but also, you know, pressured by society, blah, 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 to like pluck my unibrow, you know, or like put on mascara. And these are things that I can now find joy in. Like, I love makeup. I like picking out a good outfit for myself and whatever. But also, I think like being a feminine presenting person takes up a lot of time that like my butch female partner does not put into her look, or, you know, most men don't have to put into their looks.
I mean, without giving too many spoilers, this leads her to, I mean, if you've seen any promo for it, you see that Sanaa Lathan is bald at a point. So this leads her to cutting off all of her hair. And when she goes back into the office, I think one of the interest, she's an executive at a ad agency and has been marketing the ideal beauty type to women, which is also ironic in some ways. And, you know, when she comes back after cutting her hair, her boss says to her, like, this is not what I meant by like, get your head on straight, right? Or people, like, she ends up to inadvertently being invited to a cancer support group. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea that like, so just thinking about what you were just saying, Christina, around like, you know, what would it mean if we didn't put on makeup? What would it mean if we didn't wear pluck our eyebrows? I think people would just think that we're all very sick.
I need to jump in here for a second here and ask you a question, Verilyn, because I'm really curious about your thoughts on the two competing male suitors in the movie. So we have the first man who you already mentioned that she wakes up in bed with. He's a physician and he has certain expectations about what a Black woman should look like with regard to her hair.
Which, even though he started off by chastising her that I feel like I don't know you. You never like are real. And then later on it's revealed that like that was a clear expectation that he
had. Yes. It is expected that your hair always be straight and you never get yourself wet and so on. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have her other suitor, the hairdresser, who is very sanctimonious about straightening a woman's hairs, essentially the same thing as putting like a dog down at the veterinarian. Right. So we have these two suitors who represent two very, very specific points of view about women, Black women and their hair. Mm-hmm. And I hope I'm allowed to give a spoiler here. One thing I loved about the movie is that she ends up with neither of them.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Yeah.
I loved that.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear, Verilyn, from you, what your thoughts are on these two guys.
I mean, it's so they fit into such stereotypical tropes, right? The one that is wants to straight hair is the light skinned doctor buff dude. And then the other one is the darker skinned. also, he has an adorable little girl that I feel like is amazing. But like, it starts off with her hair, like when she first meets Violet, her hair is kind of like in a unkempt looking way. And I'm just like, even if your hair is natural, it don't need to look like that. I'm like, why is that little girl hair not done?
I know her dad is a hairdresser. I thought the same thing. I'm like, your dad is a hairdresser.
I'm sorry. I was like, this has nothing to do with straight nappy curls. Like, her hair just wasn't done, and that is, I mean, you're a hairdresser, that's not okay. I think they were both supposed to be ideals of the opposite end of the spectrum, which is fine for the film, but ultimately, like, she should be able to do whatever the hell she wants, whether she wants to put a weave in one day, whether she wants it to be straight. I think it's the expectation that it has to be a certain way, and I don't think that either of them were really saying that. I think even the guy that was accepting of her curls was still kind of just like, this is the way that you're more beautiful, and it's like, no, I should be able to do whatever the hell I want.
Yeah. I was kind of disappointed that the moral of the story seemed to be, you know, you should be able to define yourself outside of the expectations of men and outside the expectations of this Eurocentric, you know, beauty standard that we have. But then it takes a man to make her realize that, you know, once he says like, oh, you know, your hair is beautiful the way it is, and let me rub this oil on your scalp.
Do you think that he did that? Oh, I think the little girl did it. I feel like
I think he did because he's sort of like, you know, she doesn't want to chill with him. And then he's like, no, stay. I'm making this stew. They go to when they're on their first date, she sees casual and she like runs into the,
yeah.
Her hair was already cut by the time she makes the stew.
There's more though. She's starting to let her hair down because she hasn't accepted that her short hair is amazing yet. And then when she shows up on the first date and he's wearing a casual outfit, she goes into a gift shop and is like, oh, now I can wear this comfortable outfit. And then she orders a salad. He orders a burger, and then she's like, never mind, I want a burger, which I thought that that was sending weird mixed messages about, like, what if she's a person who likes salad? You know, like, who actually is this person, or is she just sort of shaping herself to what he is, or it took him to make her realize, like, oh, I don't have to eat vegetables all the time. I could eat fries on this date because I feel like it.
But I think that was part of her journey. Part of her journey was, I am trying to be perfect, or I am trying to please men. And then in the end, that's why I love the end of this movie so much, because the grand conclusion is I only have to love myself. Mm-hmm. I don't have to choose either of you or your definitions of what makes me beautiful.
Yeah.
But I feel that she had to try on a few different identities, and she does it quite literally with her hair throughout the movie,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And so in the end,
I mean, the end is cheesy as AF.
It is cheesy, but I love it.
If you love rom-coms, which I feel like we do.
Yes, Marilyn and I both love rom-coms.
it fits into the rom-com, like, tropes, but it's great. It's like, why don't get black girls get to have these corny endings? Like, that's fine as well. I mean, one thing I will say as far as, like, whether he was the reason, I think some of it is, like, you need... almost like you need permission. It's not that he's giving her permission, but like, you need permission. So when I wore my hair natural for a long time before I actually wore it out naturally. And I always say the thing that made me wear it out naturally was like when I moved to Brooklyn and I just saw black women all over the place just wearing their hair natural. And I will never forget the first time I walked out my house with my hair in like an afro. And like, you have a feeling of like, is everyone staring at me? And it's like, no one is looking at you, girl. No one cares. And if anything, you see like other beautiful black women just being like, oh, girl, I love your earrings. Oh, I love your hair. Oh, what was the twist out? Like, just like these random moments of like affirmation and like sharing that happens, that just like, I think gave me permission. So even though I stopped using the creamy crack and like I wasn't perming my hair anymore, I think like in order for me to have permission to wear it out, it took like seeing myself reflected in my neighborhood and honestly hearing people say like, oh, you look cute today. But one thing, I mean, one of the criticisms I've been hearing a lot, too, is just like, oh, this movie feels so dated that, you know, why is it coming out now? And honestly, it, like, how revolutionary would this movie have been if it had come out the same time as Chris Rock's Good Hair back in the day? And the my answer to that, though, is just like, we have it now. Like, let's just, you know what I mean? Like, we couldn't have it then because of all, like, the same things we used to talk about on Represent, R.I.P., you know, about like representation and who gets to green light these movies. Like, it's here now. And I think like we are in a play of in a different place, but I do think that we still need these like images and this, these like affirmations.
And I would also argue that looking to rom-coms to be the trailblazers for what happens in society and acceptance means you're probably not paying attention to rom-coms. You know, they're not usually going to be the place you go to for all of the important discourse about society, gender, race, and class.
Yeah. And there were so many good rom-com tropes in this. I mean, like the moment that she sort of like finds her initial boyfriend's ring in the closet or like a box that looks like it has engagement ring on it. I'm like, he's not going to propose.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know what's going to happen. There's a scene where she shaves her head off. There's a scene where they all jump into the pool with their clothes on. It's like they're checking off the boxes of a romantic comedy. But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people have made this point better than I have. But just the putting a black woman with natural hair and who's grappling with how to make her hair, you know, or grappling to accept her hair in the central role in all of those tropes does make it a big deal.
Mm-hmm. And so instead of, and we're totally spoiling this film, and this is like a little less of a spoiler, the thing that it wasn't a ring, it was a collar for a dog because he got her a dog. Don't get a woman a dog if she hasn't expressly told you she wants a dog.
Don't get her a living thing. A plant, maybe, but not like, an animal.
Why would you get her an animal? Like, here's a responsibility.
Because it's a romantic comedy. This is what happens.
Here's another thing you have to spend time on.
I know. And then they break up and he doesn't take the dog. I was so preoccupied with that. I was like, why is she still having this dog?
Okay, I need to change the subject entirely just for one moment because I'm not sure if you guys knew this, but the actress who plays Violet, Sanaa Lathan, she actually shaved her head for real in a single take during that pivotal scene. And I was just astounded when I learned that. I thought, oh, they have some good special effects and makeup people. And then when I learned that, I was like, that is unbelievable to me.
That's when I first heard, like, knew this movie was coming a couple of months ago. She posted a picture of her bald head. And hashtag Napoli Ever After or something like that. And anyone that knows the books, I don't read the books, but there was a lot of conversations of excitement. The fact that these, because it's a series, a Napoli series, that it was happening. She's such a beautiful woman. I mean, like,
she's gorgeous.
She can like literally do, I mean, anything. She could put like a bird on her head and it would like be beautiful.
All right, listeners, let us know what you thought of this movie and how you did or didn't see it reflected in your own life. I'll be really interested to see your responses. Our email is thewaves@slate.com. Now it's time for our recommendations. I read a piece from last fall in The New Yorker. One of my colleagues mentioned it. I thought it sounded good, so I Googled it. And I think that everyone should read it. Everyone who's interested in politics should read it. It's a profile of Tulsi Gabbard, the congressional representative from Hawaii's 2nd District. The profile is by Kelefa Sane. And Tulsi Gabbard has sort of been a black box to me. She was extremely young when she got elected. I knew she had done some things that were out of character for any congressperson, much less a Democratic congressperson, such as going to Syria to hang out with Bashar al-Assad. And it seems like she thinks he's doing a great job over there and refuses to believe that he has deployed chemical weapons against his own people. And she endorsed Bernie Sanders, but she started out extremely socially conservative and anti-gay and, you know, still kind of can't speak in a natural way about gay rights. She's flirted with Islamophobia, which has made some right-wingers really love her. And reading this piece helped me understand the roots of some of her beliefs and inconsistencies in her beliefs. The main root seems to be this new agey pseudo-Hindu surfer guru that she has been following since she was a child. This guy who's affiliated with a multi-level marketing company. Some of his followers have said it was like a cult that they had to eat the sand that he walked on. You know, and it's quite possible that he's a lot more conventional than that. But this is somebody who Tulsi Gabbard's father began following, and then she sort of grew up with his teachings. A lot of the people who work for her are affiliated with him. And even, you know, aside from the fact that she is a congresswoman who is getting more and more famous and has been, it seems like she's maybe considering running for president in 2020. It's just a really good story and really it describes a culture and a religious group in Hawaii that I didn't know existed. So I highly recommend that. Again, it's by Kelefa Sane in The New Yorker from last fall.
Fascinating.
I will go next. I feel like this is going to be such a bougie recommendation. But as you all know, I just came back from Italy. And I want to recommend siestas. So
yes, I endorse this message.
So that is the time of day, like maybe between 5 to 7, where like all the restaurants in Italy close. And I think presumably they're taking a nap, but maybe they're just taking a break. And during that time, places have what they call the aperitivo, which is like you get a drink and then they give you like all the food. It's amazing.
All the food?
I mean, they give you like a lot of food. Like I remember the first place I went. So I have also I recommend getting a spritz, which is Prosecco, Aperol, and soda water. It is my new favorite drink. And so you go, you order your spritz, and then they give you like a platter of food with your drink. It's amazing.
I'm going to your house later and we're going to do this.
Yes. It's absolutely amazing. And then I was also going to recommend night flights. Because I took a flight in the evening and ended up, I mean, like literally it helped with my jet lag. I watched so many films on the plane, including Love, Simon, which I cried. Has anyone ever seen this film? I highly recommend it. It's like another kind of like cheesy.
It's a teen
it sounds
romance.
Like you just recommend your life, Marilyn.
So far this is three things. Siesta, spritzes, and I guess night flights.
And like and Love, Simon.
And Love, Simon. I'll stop there.
Basically, you need to open a travel agency.
I should.
All right. I am going to recommend White Houses, which is a novel by Amy Bloom, which came out earlier this year. And I just read it for my book club. And in this book, Lorena Hickok, who was the journalist who was also Eleanor Roosevelt's, quote, first friend, as they called her. This tells her story from a first-person fictional point of view. Being on the road with Eleanor, a very passionate love that they shared, how they compromised with the fact that she was married to FDR, FDR's many affairs. And I just love any kind of novel that gets inside the story of someone historic that we've all learned about and just gives a different, more human point of view on things. And so in this story, I think anybody would love it who's just curious about either history of the FDR White House, anyone who has been in a long-term relationship, anybody who is curious about LGBT history. I just think there's so much beautiful stuff in this book just about the endurance of love and the compromises we make in love. White Houses by Amy Bloom. Highly recommend it.
Yes.
Wow, that sounds really good.
Beautiful.
I'm kind of sad that you didn't recommend a self-help book.
No, because if I do that, you'll know what book I'm living by right now. We never give that away.
All right. Thank you so much to our production assistant, Alex Barish, and our producer, Danielle Hewitt. If you like The Waves, please subscribe on your podcast app and give us a nice rating. For Verilyn Williams and Kristen Meinzer, I'm Christina Cotarucci. Thanks, as always, for listening.